Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I try to bring people who I feel are really at the cutting edge of a spiritual evolution, revolution that's happening in consciousness in this country and around the world. And tonight's guest, I feel, is really someone who puts it all together from an Eastern and Western perspective. He's one of the world's leading scholars on Hindu tantrism and the esoteric traditions of the goddess. His name is Douglas Brooks. Douglas, thank you.
Hey, Alan, thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, I mean, I've wanted to talk to you ever since I heard your first lecture that I went to about 10 years ago and said, wow, this guy really knows a little bit more than the average bear, I suppose.
Kind of you to say.
Right, no, but no, what I want to say is I've talked to a lot of people about Tantra, and from what I've heard of you, your understanding of Tantra is I would make a comparison, the difference between listening to classical music and listening to elevator music. You know, it's like you really have the classical understanding, and all these other people are just throwing around the word Tantra and trying to make it mean something. Is that fair to say for these pseudo-Tantra people that they don't really know what they're talking about?
Well, I think a good bit of what has come to the West as Tantra doesn't fairly represent or much reflect either the histories or the traditions or the practices that evolved in that enormously complex and sophisticated and confusing and jumbled world of medieval India in which Tantra first appeared. And so much of what we have nowadays is just a facsimile of reality, you know, not really anything like what authenticity and tradition really had to offer us. So I think my own work is really an attempt to bring together both an honest historical and authentic sort of look at the history of Tantra and the texts and sources and tradition and personage involved, and also to reflect upon my own experience, in South India over the last 30 years with my own teacher, who was a householder and a great tantric master.
Well, what the West knows of Tantra is basically a sort of sensuality, sexuality practice. I mean, how much of that actually is a part of the true Kashmir Shaivism history of Tantra?
Well, there is a great interest in sexuality and in intimacy in the history of Tantra, because Tantra deals so much with the gift of human embodiment. It deals so directly with our feelings, our human desires, the gift of having been born a desirous being. Mm-hmm. The exaggeration we find, I think, in so much kind of recent or Western reflection on Tantra is the reduction of Tantra to sex. Or the emphasis on sexuality for, you know, kind of transgressive or for reasons that don't have anything much to do with the very sort of interesting and profound issues of human intimacy, of the possibility of living a sensual life in all kinds of intimacy, not just sexual intimacy.
But
that's very much at the heart of Tantra, this notion of intimacy being of many kinds, including sexual intimacy, but not all of it. And that's where I think things have gotten far off the deep end.
Well, but my understanding is, let's say we're using the body in Tantra to know that you're not the body. We're consciousness incarnate, and sensuality or sexuality is a great way of observing that dance, as you might call it. Is that true?
Well, quite so. Although we might say that everything in the Tantra is the body. I mean, the universe is a body embodying bodies. And so I'd be a little more reluctant to say we're not the body and say that the body extends beyond the physical or manifest boundaries, the simple notions of being a limited mortal and conditioned body. But everything in the universe, from the tantric point of view, well, one of the great words we use is kaulika, which means held inside a body or embodying bodies. Mm-hmm. And so there's a certain way in which the gift of embodiment is the gift of the immortal choosing to become mortal. And so that expression of the body becomes a means of experiencing more fully that extraordinary choice of the immortal to appear as our own person, as our own body.
But how would you actually, just to like get it down to basics in a sense, how would you define the word tantra? I mean, what does that mean in Sanskrit, and how is it evolved in that meaning through the schools you've studied?
Well, that's really a wonderful question. I mean, first let's just go to the word itself in Sanskrit. And there are two traditional etymologies, two ways to get at the word. The first is to see the word from the verbal root that means, the verbal root is tan, T-A-N, and it means to extend, to stretch. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, to see this extension of reality as this ever-expanding universe as looming and offering itself into this process of extension, stretching, expanding, moving into the more, moving into the greater. And then the second traditional etymology takes the word tantra to mean a loom, as if the universe weaves, warp, and weft itself into this magnificent fabric of consciousness. The loom of consciousness is tantra. And so the universe is a tantra. And then, of course, in a more historical way, tantra refers to a body of revelation, of insight, of literature that really emerged out of the great sophistications of yoga that began to appear in the 4th and 5th centuries, and then in a certain way culminating philosophically in the 8th and 9th and 10th centuries in Kashmir, and what you just mentioned is Kashmir Shaivism. So tantra refers to a very specific body of an enormous body of literature and reflection, poetry, insight, and philosophy that the yoga traditions and the Indian philosophical traditions call tantra. There are other words that are... Go ahead.
Yeah. No, there are other words. Go ahead and say...
So there are other words that capture the sensibility of tantra and mean very much the same thing. Tantra, agama is another word, that which has come and that which offers revelation. Or the word yamala, which means union, or that very special sense of intimate combination. So the power to coalesce and combine, to create yoga, to create engagement. All of these are at the very heart of the meaning of the word tantra.
And there's also the other, when I was in India and also picked up some books, the idea of tantrikas were almost like black magicians. They would have all this power and they would throw it around. Is that connected to the study that you're talking about as well?
Well, certainly the history of tantra in India includes all kinds of associations with black magic, with the manipulation of power, with usury and transgression, a whole kind of abuse of the prospect of being a powerful person. I mean, one of the things that's very much true about the heart of the tantra is that these are traditions that view the universe as powerful and view yoga as a process of empowerment. And so the slippery slope to manipulation, to charlatanism, to abuse, well, that's pretty easy to see. I mean, in contemporary India, I don't think very many people would want to be called nor refer to themselves as tantrikas, you know, as practitioners of the tantra. That's a very sort of...
Yeah.
That's not the kind of word people want to associate with. And even my own teacher, who was a magnificent tantric master, you would have to sort of ask him in three different ways if he was a tantrika before he would begin to go down that road of self-description, because of the innuendo and because of the suggestion that tantra is little more than sort of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know, just
Right.
Just human abuse, basically. And much of that bad reputation is, in my estimate, pretty well deserved. I mean, there's a lot more black magic and charlatanism and fakery than there is authenticity. But should we be really particularly surprised by that?
Yeah. But there's those books by Savoda, the Agori books. I mean, those aren't charlatans. Those are real heavy practices of power.
Yeah, those are very serious. The tantra of what we call the Vamachar or the left is very serious and a not for prime time kind of a story. I mean, my own teacher was not a Vamachar. He wasn't much like an Agori or what we call Kapalikas, the skull-bearing, ash-smeared, or hiding in plain sight kind of crazy yogi notions.
The Avadhuts, right? They call them
right, Avadhuts. The Avadhuts. Yeah, the Avadhuts and various sort of yogi types. But what Robert Svoboda and others have done is reveal a very secret and sometimes, you know, tawdry underbelly of the tantra that's easily misunderstood. You know, one of the things that you find in a Agori tradition is this idea that freedom expresses itself by defying or transcending or transgressing any possible relationship to normalcy or to the status quo. And so you are as free as you are sort of willing to go to those places of outrage or transgression. And one of the things that we see, and we even see it in the Agori work, is that it's just a way of upping the ante. I mean, in a curious way, those kinds of really radical tantra are no different than traditions of purification. Because how pure is pure, and how radical is radical? I mean, the next thing you know, the only thing you can do is tell the next outlandish story.
Right, or do the next outlandish sort of ritual, right?
And, exactly, and it's sort of like standing under a shower on a hot Indian summer day. Like, you know, how long would you have to be there to be pure? Well, you know, you could just stay there forever. So there's a sort of irony to the whole notion that your freedom is contingent on kind of, you know, stepping past or beyond the nomos or any sense of what the world expects of you. That's certainly not the kind of tantra that I learned.
No, the kind of tantra I think that you're talking about and we haven't talked about yet is this essence of the divine feminine, the goddess tradition. So go into that because I think that's a kind of new phase for Western culture and also, you know, the whole influence of the East and the emergence of the feminine. So I think that's really important in what you're saying.
Well, there are so many, many traditions of goddess-centered or Shakta Tantra that have existed in India over the centuries. And the particular traditions that I learned are called Srividya, or auspicious wisdom. And even among these goddess traditions, there's an enormous variety and contrast between lineages and teachings, and a great variety. It's really important always to understand that Tantra was taught from teacher to student in lineages and in orality, and that each of these traditions themselves really stand for a very close conversation. And so there are as many traditions as there are lineages that represent them. So let's just start there, but
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
You know, I mean, just in our in the way I learned the auspicious wisdom, the Srividya, my own lineage was very much centered on the idea that this embodied and empowered universe of the Shakti, you know, the powerful, is encoded or appears feminine because of its yearning and irresistible desire to offer itself to us, to the universe itself in its own form. And that this auspicious or Shri is filled with abundance and value and affirmation, and that it's always expanding and offering a greater sense of possibility and a greater sense of of opening and opportunity, and that our yoga is a yoga of stepping into those expanding possibilities without a kind of fixed notion of attainment or realization. We are one of the very few lineages, I think, that really talk about how our yoga is an expansive process of endeavoring into a conversation with the universe, into a deeper, playful relationship with an unfinished, creative process, rather than saying, well, we've got it, this is the enlightenment, follow this recipe, achieve this insight, and somehow you've got it, whatever, you know, whatever is defined as sort of the final realization. And our lineage, that realization is really a process, and that goal is really a conversation.
Well, even in your lecture, that was exciting when you said that in the lecture, that what the goal of, or not the goal, but the thing, we're always becoming. The universe is a, is an ongoing creative project, let's say.
Yeah, and so too our yoga has to advance and align and progress even as we evolve our consciousness. You know, so many yogas are taught as if long ago and far away the Great One got it. And our job is to kind of go back and retrieve that golden, you know, that golden age, or step into that long ago and forgotten truth that has always been true. But in the lineage of the auspicious wisdom that I was reared in, that my teacher called Rajanika Yoga. In Rajanika Yoga, that process of awakening is an ever ongoing process. It's an endeavor, not an attainment. It's a willingness to evolve and to progress in our understanding, because that's what the universe is doing. The universe is expanding, and ours is a yoga of alignment rather than achievement. So it's a very different kind of idea, that we have to be as progressive as our own consciousness and continue to evolve the yoga. You know, when my teacher taught, we would read the great sources in the original, you know, in Sanskrit, many sources in Tamil and other languages, and very often he would ask me for an example, he would say, well, what do you think of that? Or, you know, this or that idea. And, you know, in my sort of cleverness, I'd always try to refer to some other text, you know, kind of show him that I'd done my homework. And he'd look at me, you know, very sort of sweetly and say, no, I mean, in your own experience, how does this apply to us today? He would say, it's very wonderful, Alan, he would stop and he would say, you know, it's not the 11th century anymore, you know, in reference to the text we were reading or to something else. So that our yoga must evolve with, on in the footsteps of great beings and with deference to tradition, but not in a kind of replication or in a kind of slavish adherence to the past.
Right. It makes it very contemporary and exciting, and part of what is ongoing and being creative. I mean, in the West, though, there's always been this dialogue between being and becoming, you know, and that's
right.
Sort of what, and that's an ongoing discussion, and I think it's like even part of, like, the biblical text, they say the God's name or whatever you want to call that is not I am that I am, it's I am that which I am becoming. And so it's not a new thing, this way of, this attitude of your particular school. It's
we wouldn't suggest anything of the sort, but rather that it's part of seeing life not as a problem. So many yogas treat us as if, you know, this great blessing of embodiment is a wonderful thing, but there's still this work to be done. And so we come into this world sort of unfinished and blessed, but because we've been given human birth. But on the other hand, we come in with a kind of problematic to fix. And yoga offers those solutions, and there's a kind of freedom or liberation or awakening at the end of the rainbow. In the Rajanika tradition, instead of seeing life as a problem to be solved, My teacher used to say, life is filled with these magnificent paradoxes to be embraced. And one of those paradoxes is just the one you just mentioned, this relationship between being and becoming. And the way we see that is that there is a depth and truth to being that makes it the case that we're all human, and we always have been. And the things that are true about us, that we long and love, that we live and yearn and die, that we experience joy and hurt and profit and loss, that these great sort of human, universal, perennial issues of our being are always in a process of becoming, and that we experience those things that are always true as true in time and in ourselves and in place, and so that they are both being and becoming truths.
Right.
And we weave that paradox, warp and weft, like a tantra.
So it's the paradox of being, and it seems like what I'm getting is that because we are this body, or we're in this body, which is the goddess, and we're also this consciousness, which is the Shiva quality, it's that constant play between the Shakti and the Shiva. Would that be appropriate ways of using those terms, between consciousness and embodiment?
Oh, I think that's certainly one of the ways the Tantra loves to talk about the way in which our immortal presence, our consciousness, Shiva, appears in the ever-renewing expression of the mortal play of power in the Shakti. And so the allegory of Shiva and Shakti, the language of Tantra, is always a language of being and becoming, of mortal and immortal, of conditioned and unconditioned realities weaving themselves sort of endlessly and expanding into each other.
Right. So if there's all this, and it's this constant play in every being that is conscious, then the evolution of these beings, though, me and you and everyone else, happens when we undertake certain pathways of discovery that brings us to a new level of realization. I'm asking, where's our evolution within this path? And maybe there isn't an evolution, but there seems like there's something we do at some point, or a ritual or practice, that suddenly we have a bigger view of reality. What is that that we can do, or need to do, or should do?
Well, like all great teachings, you know, yoga promises that if something is excellent, it will be difficult, and if it's valuable, it will be rare. Mm-hmm. And so that commitment to practice isn't some fly-by-night, you know, gee, I wish I were enlightened by tomorrow. But it is really true that a great yoga practice that engages the body and the mind and the heart and works with these subtle and rather tested and experimented truths of tantric practice, things like mantra and meditation and mudra, all of these combine to give us real experiential evaluation. Like, they give us tools to evaluate and understand ourselves more deeply, and to really have the experience of opening and of awakening and of growth. And I think it's fair to say that that growth happens really with alacrity. You know, it happens really quickly and profoundly, even as we begin. I mean, just a little practice will take anyone really much, much further.
Like a little bit of meditation, a little of some mantras. That's what
exactly.
You mean by practice. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, mantra meditation, or I mean, there are all different kinds of meditation and practice, and this way in which we, if we go inside ourselves to come out, and if we bring ourselves to some place where that reflective consciousness really begins to align and absorb with that the inner pulsations of the heart and the mind. When we go to those places in meditation, or we even just, those things can even happen, you know, on a yoga mat or while you're riding your bicycle or walking down the street. I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which the power of reflective consciousness can bring about, you know, revelation and reflection and recognition. Those are the three great teachings of a meditation practice, that the universe is revealing itself to us all the time, and that we are engaged endlessly and continuously in a process of reflection, and that we can, in the end, step more deeply into recognition, to recognize, to see ourselves again and again as the self in all beings, and all beings as that self. And that sense of identity and that power of appreciating difference, that beauty in the world, all of those things come together with just a little bit of practice. I mean, the amount of advance people can make if they just commit themselves to 15, 25, 30 minutes a day for a short period of time is just remarkable. Now, one of the things that's true about that, Alan, though, is that as you advance in your practices, as you become a more dedicated and sophisticated practitioner of meditation, and particularly the more sophisticated kinds of meditation, it's our tradition's belief that you shouldn't really expect great breakthroughs every day. That, you know, you're counting prime numbers, and those first 15, 20, well, all the way up to 43, you know, you can find those pretty easily. Once you start getting at the more advanced levels, it's a much more incremental and more beautifully evolving and ecstatic practice. Let me put it one other way. My teacher used to say that our spiritual breakthroughs are really more like acquiring fluency in language. I mean, no one really knows. Like, you don't really wake up one day and go, "Oh, today I'm fluent." You know, this virtuosity in becoming ourselves. You know, that's yoga. To become a virtuoso in your own self and your own experience, that's going to be an evolving, progressive, and one might say incremental process, like fluency, like learning to speak a language.
But, you know, if you're saying that, like you said before, the universe is always evolving and consciousness, well, you didn't quite say that, but I got that, everything is changing because it's a dance with the unknown, then do practices really can't you wake up and have everything fresh and no practice really works because it's from an old form that is no longer existence? You know, because things are always moving, why does tradition work? Why does practice work? Do you know what
that's
I'm asking?
That's a great question. Because if we are unfolding into an expanding universe, why would the things behind us matter or be as effective as what lies before us?
Yeah.
That's a really good question. And I think that tradition tells us that we aren't born to mimic them or to simply sort of merely follow in their footsteps, because that would be looking in the wrong direction. That would be walking backwards. But that unless we see a path that evolves from their path, then we're kind of doomed to, you know, reinvent fire and, you know, quest for fire and reinvent the wheel. And in order to sort of evolve the technologies and the practices of that are relevant to us today and that take us forward, we would be well served to take seriously where they've been and what they've done for us. You know, if you wanted to make a better light bulb, you wouldn't start from scratch.
Right. I get that. That's fair. That's fair. So is in your practice and your teacher, who sounds like a really amazing person, he had achieved something, though, right? I mean, what could you say that, I mean, would we say enlightenment? Would you say that he reached a state where he was at peace with it all, and was that ongoing movement of the universe?
Well, I think to describe how I experienced him was someone moving fluently in the ways and currents of his own experience, so that I never imagined his state to be static or in any way kind of fixed. I mean, surely he had a graceful and easy manner, and he was incredibly alert, but certainly he would never think of himself as having been immune to feelings or emotions or even moods and experiences. I think when I think of my teacher, I think of someone who is virtuosic and fluent in savoring the experience of his own life. Even as I saw him die before my eyes, I saw him taste deeply on the palate of his experience, that he really believed that this gift of being born human was an opportunity to savor and to relish, to taste fully, you know, what life has to offer, good and bad, you know, happy and sad, for better and worse. And I don't think that he ever tried to pretend that he didn't have that full array of human emotions. You know, in our tradition, we call this the practice of radical affirmation, that we don't have to acquire something we are or get rid of something we already possess, but rather learn to dance and step more fluently and fully into our experience, whatever that experience is.
I mean, because so, is that the goal? I mean, there's these amazing texts and poetry and literature and history, Kashmir Shaivism. Is it all just about that, or is there other places that we are destined to be if we choose or can?
Well, there are certainly traditions in Kashmir Shaivism that tell us that there are deep mystical experiences that traverse multiple worlds and pathways and ultimately lead to a state of realization. In the Rajanaka Tantra, those worlds and pathways and experiences of what is possible are ongoing. They're not going to end. That is, in a curious way, that distinguishes the Shakta path, the goddess path, that as Shiva sits atop the mountain peak in full repose, the goddess continues the journey. And so that journey evolves into further worlds and into further possibilities. I mean, surely I don't mean to suggest that all we're saying is, you know, love your life more deeply because that's all there is. What we're saying is, as you love your life more deeply, there's so much more than whatever appears to be.
Well, there is, seems to be so much more just in the practice I've done. I mean, there's, you know, out-of-body experiences, and there's subtle emotions that have not been described in any words or books. I mean, there's true experiences that enrich someone just from practice, and I would think in the Hindu literature they probably have named more of them than in the West. But and in your practice, what have you discovered for yourself? Because you know you're in it, you're doing the hard work, and I'm curious about your experience. If you want to share that,
well, that's a wonderful question. Right. My own experience, I think, has shown me how open and prismatic consciousness is as you send the light of your own illumination into these, through these great prism of possibilities. You know, those prisms are openings of, and thresholds and gateways, doorways of experience that fracture that limited sense of experience and draw you into different worlds and different conversations. I think of that spiritual experience as an ever sort of deepening process of conversation where the voices and the possibilities of consciousness keep unfolding at levels and in ways that then draw themselves back into awareness. They they come back into feelings and into thoughts and into words, even though in so many ways they extend beyond them. There's a great tradition of in Tantra of bringing our experiences back into the world with us and trying to make them offerings to others as thoughts, feelings, as gifts of art or poetry to become expressive. You know, one of the things that you see in Keshmer Shaivism and you see among the Shaktas is that in the mature years of the yogi's life, we see a deeper commitment to artistry, to poetry, to self-expression, to making a gift of those inner experiences and making them something that others can appreciate, that others can find more accessible. And so to go into the privacy and into the depths of what's often ineffable or beyond ordinary description in a yogic meditation, the voices, the signs, the symbols, the images of the deities, the dances of the gods, the cycles and currents of the ongoing fulminations of the syllables and the sounds of mantra, the symphonic expression of the universe offering itself, you know, like you're looking through, you know, the Hubble telescope into the depths of the universe, and then trying to bring that back and paint a picture, you know, trying to do what the Hubble does. It takes a photograph and offers others just a brief moment in time of what is really eternity.
Wow, it sounds like a beautiful, rich palette that you're playing on, and you're a translator of these great texts, and so as you go through probably things that have never been read by Westerners, is there anything specifically you can share that you remember in the Kashmir Shaivite tradition that's been written that just kind of blew you away and you said, oh my God, this is...
Oh, Alan, I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me.
Like what? What did you discover
Just dozens and dozens of times where I know I'm reading a text or looking at something that probably hasn't been, you know, touched or considered, you know, maybe for hundreds of years, and then suddenly a simple phrase or a certain line will appear. I mean, Sure. Well, one of those moments happened many years ago. When I was translating The Ocean of the Heart, the Kulārṇava Tantra, which is a work that had been considered before, but in a curious way, the depths of its expression hadn't really been plumbed. And at one point, the Tantrika writer says, Shakti Nipata Anusarena Shishya Nogaham Gurum Arhati. He says, when one who deeply seeks the truth steps into the current of the power of grace descending, such a being becomes worthy of that awareness. And so it's by stepping into this current of grace that is the descent of this immortal power. All we need do is step into that current of grace, and we become capable of holding that immortal awareness in our own consciousness. And I was just, there's another passage that says, and merely by painting on the screen of our own awareness, so this universe appears, so this universe is a canvas for the art of that immortal power itself. And our own consciousness, so what the author is telling us is that the universe is actually a work of art in which the artist is becoming the art. The Shakti, the goddess, is the art and the artist all at once. It's just a magnificent image where the painter and the painting and the paint are really all the same reality.
That is beautiful. In your lecture, you also talked about this idea of grace that you just mentioned, the grace of the universe existence giving us everything we have as opposed to seeking it from a guru. And can you talk about that distinction? Because I think that is really important in the tradition that you're talking about.
In the Shakta tradition and the goddess-centered tradition of the Vajanaka, we don't rely upon the idea that one single being offers us what it is we need to illumine or to save ourselves, such as it is, that we don't just turn to one teacher or to one guru. In fact, we say that actually everything that we seek and everything that we need, we already possess within our own hearts, within our own minds, and that this process of revelation and reflection and recognition is the generation of grace from within our own being. And then that grace is drawn out of ourselves by our own deep desire and by that great company we keep. In the Rajanaka tradition, the guru is the community of fellow seekers. The guru is the company we keep. The word guru means the heavy, literally. That which stabilizes and makes valuable, that the weighty thing, the thing that has gravity and truth to it. And no one can give us that. That's a process we have to create in ourselves and then share, because each one of us brings a contribution and an asset and a gift. And in the Rajanaka tradition, we say we do become just as great as the company we keep. And so grace is the company we keep. And when you're in a room, you know, with great souls, like you and I just were just a few days ago, you know, you have that experience of being inspired and uplifted and supported. Like, you know you're a better person because you're in the company of greatness. And each of those beings in the room, each has a different kind of contribution. You know, I suppose, you know, maybe my particular gifts had to do with the texts and the languages and the traditions and, you know, the explanation. But everyone we meet brings something valuable and something important to the conversation. As soon as we begin to think of grace as participating in a conversation that the universe is offering, then we begin to think about it in very different ways, different from this idea that grace is something we get from outside or extrinsically. You know, in many traditions, grace means that power of blessing that we can't give ourselves. It must come from something else. And here in the Rajanaka, we're saying, you know, grace is abundant. Grace is abundance from within, and it appears in that way in which we make an offering of ourselves to others and receive the offering that others are making to us, and so participate in something greater than ourselves and receiving the blessing of our own awareness, rather than depending or believing that it's going to come from somebody else. Now, in that way, I would say these Shakta teachings, these God-offended teachings, are really, really different than many other traditions that tell us, you know, we need to get this from the guru, or we need to get this from God, or from some place that is, in some sense, outside or extrinsic to ourselves. And yet, even those Kashmir Shaivite traditions that tell us that we need, you know, the Shaktipat, the descent of grace from the guru, they do tell us that what we're really waking up is that power of the guru within us. So all we are saying in the Shakta tradition is that that power is within us, and that no one actually gives it to us, but rather we enter more deeply into a conversation in which everyone's presence uplifts and inspires and takes us to that next place.
Well, it seems like it's that paradox. No one can give it to us, yet we make ourselves available, and it arrives from somehow outside of us. So
it arrives with something more than us, because to know ourselves, we have to make an offering to something greater than ourselves. And to realize that we are here is to realize that we have been created by something far greater than ourselves. The energies of the universe, the choices of community and of family. I mean, we've been created by this great empowered choice of the universe to become us. You know, my teacher used to put it in an interesting way, Alan. He used to say, the universe has gone to a great deal of trouble to make you. So be grateful. and make yourself an offering to that universe that made you.
Well, that is a great way to live. And, you know, I've also heard stories and of beings, great beings appearing to people, maybe incarnations of the divine feminine herself have appeared through grace to people. I mean, what do you, are those just expressions of the self, or, and I guess everything is in a sense, but aren't these also beings that embody a greater consciousness that have appeared to saints and masters and even ordinary people over time?
Well, I think the visionary experiences that people have are entirely authentic. Let's just begin there. Let's just say that everyone has the veracity and the depth and the irrefragibility of their own experience. No one can take anyone's experience away. Mm-hmm. And when we see or experience consciousness in the mirror of consciousness, when we see consciousness appearing in us and through us, certainly it can take on any form it chooses. Mm-hmm. So is it possible and is it real to see great beings or images of the divine, hear voices or experience great souls in visionary ways? Certainly consciousness chooses to appear on the screen of consciousness however it chooses, however it projects, and through us. Are those beings apart from us? I never think that anything is apart from us.
Right.
Our consciousness always participates in consciousness.
Well, but that's the duality. You're apart from us, and of course you're not apart from me. I mean, you know, we're...
Exactly. And I think that when great beings... When we see great beings or gods, when we hear the voices that inspire us, we are both seeing ourselves and we are seeing more than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if we think about it, Alan, in order just to see ourselves, we have to see more than ourselves. We can't see even our own face without looking at a reflection of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the gods and the goddesses, the great beings, are reflections of consciousness reflected in our own consciousness. Are they distinctive and real? As real as the recognition of our own face in a mirror.
But isn't there a great mystery we have yet to understand? And it seems like there's, you know, we're just on the surface. I'm even talking about my own experience of something that is much deeper, that is truly the essence of consciousness that we have yet to firmly embrace. I mean, we're all walking around out there or driving around and missing the point of our own being. And it seems we have yet to create that as a group soul. And,
well, I might say we are missing the points of our own being. That there's a plurality of mystery, and what Wordsworth said, you know, he called it a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused. I think we are interfused in that sublime reality, and it is easy. I couldn't agree with you more. It is easy to walk through it and around it and by it and never even notice how rich and how profound our experience is. You know, my teacher used to say, we're so free, we were made free, that consciousness allows us to ignore her greatness. He used to say, she'll breathe us until we are done, because we are under no obligation to make ourselves that offering to that sense sublime. And yet we can. And there is so much more for us yet to experience. But I think the only thing I would really add to the way you put it was, you know, I don't think we're missing the point. I think we're missing the infinite points. I think we're missing that there is just yet so much more.
Well, in your lecture you said, from your tradition, is not necessarily the goal of anything, it's the experience of the thing that is the goal. I think that was really important.
Yeah, of course, every goal leads to the next experiment and the next experience. I mean, the goal of every great experiment isn't its conclusion, but its opening, its opportunity, and very much that process rather than that attainment, a process that keeps on going. I mean, my teacher used to put it in an interesting way, Ellen. He used to say, the perfect becomes more perfect.
Mm-hmm. And that's happening every second, probably.
And because we've begun in perfection, our imperfection is our perfection. You know, the flaws in our being are the openings to creativity and to opportunity. And like the knots in the wood make the floor beautiful before us. So imperfection is that very prospect and possibility of an ever deepening relationship to creating more perfection, and so more imperfection, and so on and so on.
Mm. So if there's one initial practice or simple thing your tradition would tell someone to do, I mean, you said reveal, reflect, recognize, but is there something you start your students with in your yoga?
Some of the very first practices really begin with that acknowledging the gift of grace in the most palpable way, and that is the breath. I mean, the breath breathes us. The breath is the offering of life embodied. And as soon as we turn our attentions to our breath, everything changes. Because, you know, naturally the breath seems to go on with or without our consent. I mean, you know, the breath is just normally and naturally present. But when we turn our awareness and pour ourselves into the natural and spontaneous movements of the breath, then the mind begins to step more deeply into the current of its own possibilities. So the first practices of meditation in the Tantra, not just in Rajanika Shakta Tantra, but I would say in virtually all the traditions of Tantra, our first awareness is to bring the mind into the body and the mind and the body into the heart through that great power of prana. You know, because in the earliest texts, even in texts long before the Tantra and the Upanishads, the word prana doesn't simply mean breath and life. It means the pulsations of the universe. It means the gift of person, the gift of grace descending and appearing. So breathing in awareness is the beginning of meditation. Because, you know, even the word meditation, dhyana, means to step into the vehicle, the going, the coming and going of consciousness. And the breath is that form of grace.
Right. So you would say breath, in a sense, really embodies what Tantra is, because here we have this vehicle and we have this energy inhabiting this vehicle in a sort of rhythmic essence of itself. So the breath is the interaction between body and movement, which
indeed,
is Tantra.
And the breath is both the gift, the blessing, and the means. In other words, the very way in which we learn to meditate, just the very act of turning to the breath, the method of the breath, is to step into the current of grace itself. So the breath is the gift. The breath is the blessing of life appearing embodied, you know, taking on form. And so we are actually, when we meditate, stepping into a reality, not just doing a practice. The breath isn't a means to an end. The breath is a means that is its own end, because it's its own beginning.
Mm. So when you say stepping into a reality of awareness is what you mean, right? The reality.
Right,
of...
exactly. That the breath is that sort of manifest form of that awareness, you know? So it's both how we do it, and it's really the gift we're being given all at once.
And then just to sort of wrap up, as you then embrace others, it would be a sort of dance of breath and breath and movement and the recognition of self and not self. It becomes a lot more complex. The dance moves become
Yes, the dance moves become much more sophisticated because we begin to move to the inner states and outward gestures like mudras. Mm. We begin to see ourselves in the mirrors and reflections and prisms of consciousness that we call the gods and goddesses, you know, these symbols and icons of the power of consciousness to imagine and see itself and enter more deeply into conversation. We begin to move into things like yantra and mandala, these diagrammatic and much more sophisticated self-expressions of symmetry and asymmetry. Of possibility and of structure. It's just a magnificent sort of invitation to self-cultivation and to self-creativity and to participation in great community, to learn these things together and to enter more deeply into a conversation that draws us into a lifetime's worth of great contemplation and collective endeavor. My teacher used to say, enlightenment is our collective endeavor. It's what we are doing when we're together.
Mm. Actually, Andrew Cohen in his magazine, What is Enlightenment, is talking about that work as well, the kind of collective awakening we're now having as a world community, Sangha. What do you call your groups?
We call it Kula. We use the old, the old word Kula, which really means choosing yourself, selecting your community. It's one of those Sanskrit words that kind of can commonly mean family or world community or clan. But in our case, it really means that we choose this participation, that we act upon our freedom to create community. And that those communities extend into other communities and that we give this empowerment of community a greater sense at every step, you know, like concentric circles where community creates more and then greater and then ultimately a world community.
I think that's where we're going. I think we're just about out of time talking to Douglas Brooks and your website. Do you want to just give people your website?
Oh, that's very sweet of you to mention. There's some information on my website. It's rajanaka.com, R-A-J-A-N-A-K-A, rajanaka.com. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to talking with you again, Alan.
Yeah, and you travel all over the country, so people can check that website, rajanaka.com, to see where you'll be. And Douglas's work goes very deep. I mean, we've just really touched on some initial points, and thank you for bringing it out to the public.
Well, thank you so much for this invitation and for this wonderful conversation. It was really terrific.
Yeah, we'll do some more, and we'll do some television interviews when you're back in New York.
Lovely.
So, thank you. I'm Alan Steinfeld. I've been talking to Douglas Brooks, expert Sanskrit scholar, Kashmir Shivai, translator of great ancient texts. And is that a good way to describe you, or how?
Well, thanks very much. an old hand at tantric practice and a college professor by day. So, thanks again.
Right, and someone who's actually doing the work. I mean, you are doing it. So thank you. Thank you again. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. And if you want to email me, you can send it to newrealities@earthlink.net. And you can also check my website, newrealities.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Douglas Brooks. And I'll be talking to people next week. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.